It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, just yesterday, my producer and I vowed that we would not get drawn in from now to Election Day by every little outrageous or provocative thing that Donald Trump says and let each one dominate the news cycle, not on this program. But this morning, as if he was thumbing his nose at us, we had to look each other in the eye and say we just can't ignore it when a presidential nominee seems to make a joke about someone assassinating Hillary Clinton if she's elected. Now, if you haven't heard it, here's the moment from a Trump rally yesterday where he was defending the Second Amendment's gun rights. And then
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day. If Hillary gets to put her judges, right now we're tied. You see what's going on.
So that's a slightly longer version than you probably heard elsewhere, because we always want to show the context of these clips that make little soundbite memes in the news. And we wanted to show in this case that he was already talking about the Second Amendment. He didn't pull that out of the blue. But still, the hub of it that's being widely replayed is very alarming, as he talks about nothing that can be done about what she'll do to the Supreme Court if elected, unless there is.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
So we'll talk about that now and some other items we had initially planned to talk about with Peter Beinart, contributing editor at The Atlantic and associate professor of journalism and political science at CUNY and a frequent critic of Trump, to be fair. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be with you.
The Trump campaign now says he was only referring to Second Amendment supporters voting to keep Clinton out of office and stopping him that way. Her that way. How did you hear it?
Well, the problem with that logic is that he was talking about what to do after she was elected and was going to appoint judges. So, we've seen this pattern before, right? The Trump surrogates try to do these cleanup operations. But if you listen, as you rightly played the text for your viewers, he's not talking about what to do to stop her from being elected. He's talking about what you could do once she's already elected and when he's going to appoint these bad judges.
So what do you make of it? I mean, I don't think Trump had thought about it in advance. He didn't set out to suggest that maybe someone should assassinate Clinton if she's elected. More likely, he just has no edit switch in his brain, as we've seen time and time again, and saw an edgy quip to make, and he made it before he could think better of it. Something like that, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. You know, Donald Trump has this strange relationship to language, or at least strange for a presidential candidate, where he speaks in an extremely kind of promiscuous, unfiltered way, and then will often kind of even contradict himself in the same sentence, or will say something like, well, I'm not sure that's really true, or I don't really know if that's true. So it has this effect of kind of throwing out things into the ether that he somehow is simultaneously saying he's not entirely responsible for. He'll often say things like, well, we don't really know, or, you know, I don't really know what's going on with that. So this is this very, I think, reckless and way in which he speaks, in which he puts things out there that are very dangerous, all kinds of conspiracy theories, all kinds of, you know, this is not the first incitement to violence, but speaks in a way in which he somehow almost suggests that, like, he's in on the joke and he doesn't take what he's saying seriously. But we've already seen that his supporters in the past have taken what he said seriously and actually committed acts of real violence.
And listeners, you can comment on this or anything about the presidential race with Peter Beinart from The Atlantic, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. There are laws, Peter, against urging people to violence against other individuals. Any chance from a legal standpoint that he may have crossed that line?
You know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't really know. I find it kind of probably hard to imagine, but I did notice that one former national security advisor did say that were this just a random person in a crowd who had been overheard seeing this, that they probably would have been taken in for questioning. So I think these things have to be taken seriously because as much as there still may be a tendency to treat Donald Trump as a joke, and in some ways, even though it at times feels like he's taking his own candidacy as a kind of a joke, it's not a joke. This man has a 25% chance of being our next president.
Dan Malloy, the governor of Connecticut, said that that line reminded him of the rhetoric in Israel before the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. We're going to play that clip later in the program. Do you think that's going too far?
It's an interesting analogy. There was a tremendous amount of incitement to hatred against Yitzhak Rabin on the Israeli right, and which Benjamin Netanyahu, I think, many believe was complicit in. Leah Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin's widow, famously refused to shake Benjamin Netanyahu's hand after the assassination of her husband. I think where you could see a parallel also is that I think there has been a level of extreme misogyny among some of Donald Trump supporters towards Hillary Clinton. This repeated chant, lock her up, that became a kind of refrain at the Republican convention. I myself, walking around in Cleveland, was just appalled at how crudely sexist so much of the Trump paraphernalia was. And I think that's part of the culture that has been that Donald Trump is inciting here, I think genuinely could kind of play itself out in dangerous ways.
What's the bigger implication, in your opinion, as a Trump critic, as we acknowledge, about what it says about if anything it says about his fitness for office?
Look, I think he has, you know, almost every day since running for president, I think he has made clear his lack of fitness for office, both in terms of temperance, sheer ignorance of basic information, you know, at two different points, not knowing what the nuclear triad was, for instance. But I think what's fascinating and frightening here is that a lot of the way we conduct American politics is not based on law. It's based on norms. It's based on the way things have always been done, certain limits that have been set, not because they're enshrined in law, but just because that's culture. That's the way our political culture has played itself out. Donald Trump is testing those in some very important ways. And I think there's a real challenge for Americans, and especially for Republicans, in terms of whether they're going to allow themselves to be complicit in a candidacy which is threatens to change American political culture in some very dangerous ways.
Let's take a phone call. Samantha in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, Brian. I'm so delighted that you are breaking your rule with your producer in putting this on. One of the things that seems to not be replayed as much, and I'm so glad that you did this morning, but I didn't hear it on Morning Edition, is after the comment about we'll get the Second Amendment people after her, whatever he says there, he says that will be a terrible day. And that doesn't seem to be getting the attention. So whether or not he's backing off from it later on, what his intention was at the time he said it seems to be pretty serious when he says that would be a terrible day.
When he said that would be a terrible day, I'll get it and replay it because I hadn't been focusing on that line. But I think, as I recall it, he meant it would be a terrible day if Hillary Clinton is elected and gets to appoint the replacement for Scalia on the Supreme Court. Did you hear it differently?
I did hear it differently, Brian, and perhaps I'm mishearing that, but I heard we're going to get the Second Amendment folks after her or something like that. I may be paraphrasing a bit. And then I think he said that would be a terrible day, or there may have been a sentence in there, right. But that would be a terrible day is a pretty telling comment, whether or not he backs off from it later on.
All right, stay here for a second. So here's that 31 seconds again.
Hillary wants to abolish, essentially abolish, the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day. If Hillary gets to put her judges, right now we're tied. You see what's going on.
That would be a horrible day if Hillary gets to put her judges. So I don't know. We could overparse this, too.
No, but you're right, Brian, maybe with that if, and I wasn't concentrating on the if, so you're right. I think he brings it back to that. But the sequitur, for some reason, did catch my ear.
All right.
At the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And, Peter, what I did notice on that re-airing of the clip was a little cheer from the crowd after he said, well, maybe the Second Amendment people will have something to say about that.
Right. And again, this is typical of the kind of impact, you know, that Donald Trump, the interplay between him and his supporters. And, you know, we've seen this with the violence at his rallies where people have committed acts of violence and then he kind of either congratulated them or said, you know, egged them on or, you know, romantically talked about how it was great in the old days when people used to be brought out on stretchers. And so, you know, we've also seen this in things with, you know, his Muslim ban, for instance. You know, poll after poll showed that in virtually every state, majority of Republicans supported his Muslim ban. Now, would they have supported a ban on, even thought about banning all Muslims from coming to the United States if Donald Trump had not suggested it? So Donald Trump throws these ideas out there, and then dangerous ideas, bigoted ideas, then they get a kind of positive response, and we're kind of off to the races. I just wanted to also just mention quickly that, you know, one of the things that's so disturbing about the way this plays out is that because Donald Trump says things that are extraordinarily outrageous, like, you know, maybe someone should shoot Hillary Clinton, the other stuff gets lost, right? His earlier statement that Hillary Clinton essentially wants to abolish the Second Amendment, that itself is absurd, right? If you look at what Hillary Clinton is actually suggesting, you know, preventing people who are on the terrorist watch list from getting weapons, trying to strengthen background checks and the gun show loophole. I mean, this is so far away from abolishing the Second Amendment, we don't even pay attention to that, right? Because it's dwarfed by Trump's even more outrageous statements.
It's really a great point. And if he didn't go where he went afterwards, that would probably be the source of, like, a legitimate fact check, which is him saying as a setup to that, Clinton wants to abolish the Second Amendment. No, she says she doesn't want to abolish the Second Amendment. She wants to protect gun rights. She just wants to add these particular controls. But you're right. The nuance of the policy debate or the exaggeration of her position kind of gets lost when he seems to be suggesting that maybe she should be assassinated in the next breath. This can't be good for the particular poll problems that Trump has started to have. Real erosion among Republican-leaning women who vote a lot. The most notable stat from the Monmouth poll this week, besides Clinton's 13-point lead, the biggest measured yet overall lead, is that Romney won white college-educated women by 6 points in 2012. He won that demographic, white college-educated women. Trump now trails among them by 30 points. Do you find that as significant as it sounds like it might be?
Yeah, it's extraordinarily significant. Now we have to remember that Donald Trump is overperforming among non-college educated men, where Hillary Clinton has tremendous weakness. So that balances out a little bit. But yeah, what we're seeing in the Trump campaign is an acceleration of a larger trend in which the Republican Party is having tremendous problems with college educated voters and especially college educated women. And I think that, you know, the challenge for the Republican Party has to think about is going to be how do they get beyond this? If Trump does lose, how are they going to – the Republican Party already had a weak brand among some key constituency groups even before Trump was nominated. How on earth can the party do something significant enough to change its brand now that the brand has been hurt, damaged even that much more by Donald Trump? It's going to be a very, very difficult challenge that's going to take Republicans a long time to overcome.
Jordan at Rutgers. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
So I just think that it's kind of insane that Donald Trump, I mean, you think about these facts, he says, oh, he's joking. But there's no real realm for joking when you're the leader of the, you know, leader of the free world, president of the United States. I think that the point comes where I'm not necessarily a Hillary supporter. I'm an independent. And I think it's so frustrating that people think you have to just kind of, you have to be pro-Hillary to be anti-Trump. I just think Trump's, the idea of Trump as president, I mean, he's got the Nazi Party of America supporting him.
Who are you going to vote for?
I'm going to vote for Hillary. I think that she's a better option than a lot of the third party candidates, and I think she's definitely a better option than Trump. I don't think she's the best option we've seen, but I think she's a better option than Trump.
Thank you very much. Nathan in Kings Point, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Brian. I think it's time for the Article 9 provision that the RNC has at its disposal to invoke it and remove the nomination away from Trump. He's just gone too far. And I have a quick guest suggestion for you.
Uh-huh.
I know you have 30 issues in 30 days. How about 30 Republicans in 30 days? You have Susan Molinari, Christopher Shays, George Pataki, Christy Whitman, among others. Have each one on your program and ask them flat out, do they support Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? And have these people held accountable. Every Republican needs to get off the fence and say whether they support Trump after all the garbage that he spewed in this campaign.
Nathan, what's the Article 9 that you refer to of the RNC Charter?
It's something called Article 9. I've heard people discuss it on MSNBC and CNN, and they said that there is a provision that a group of 16 Republicans at the RNC can, they have the authority to take the nomination away from a candidate. And I think Trump needs to have he's mentally unfit. He's gone too far. You had John Dickerson last week. You guys were saying how in the past, everyone says this election is the dirtiest, this is the ugliest, and I dispute that. Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Dwight Eisenhower, both Bushes, none of them at their worst ever came close to spewing the garbage that Trump has in the past 6 months. And as I said, I think you should get people like Christopher Shays, Christy Whitman, George Pataki, Susan Molinari, every Republican elected official that you could think of in the tri-state area. Put them on your show and say, are you for Trump or Clinton? And if they can't answer, you got to grill them.
Nathan, thank you very much. Now, of course, everybody who he mentions are former politicians who are out of office, kind of yesterday's news. What we have been doing, what we did do during the Republican convention, was canvass all the Republican members of Congress from the tri-state area and see who was actually going to the Republican convention, and almost none of them were. We went over that list at the time, and we will see, as the election gets closer, who among the current Republicans, at least, are deciding to vote for Trump or distancing themselves as more people are distancing themselves. Do you know that Article 9, Peter?
No, I wasn't aware of that. And I mean, I do know there's a provision if the candidate withdraws. I wasn't aware, although I could be wrong, of the party being able to do that once they've nominated the candidate. I think given that the Republicans couldn't even launch a serious opposition effort at the convention itself, this seems to me very unlikely. But I do think that we are, as the caller said, in really uncharted territory. I mean, I think one thing that you have to think about is if Donald Trump were to be elected president, what are the chances that this could provoke some kind of real constitutional crisis? I mean, the military leaders have already said they would not follow Donald Trump's orders if they were ordered to torture, for instance, or kill the families of terrorist members. What are the possibilities that we might have other institutions of government, whether it be the courts or the military, that ended up in some kind of constitutional crisis with Donald Trump because they felt they had to try to prevent a president who would not remain bound by the Constitution? I think that could be a very serious problem.
He certainly would stand, the way he behaves, a pretty serious risk of being impeached, maybe early in his presidency, even with a Republican Congress.
I think that's a really good point, right? I think, and this is again why this situation would be so debilitating, right? I think that you're very right. I think we probably would have impeachment proceedings from one, or one, you know, and again, that would be a terrible, terrible thing for our political system. There would be a serious crisis of legitimacy for Trump, but also for whoever followed Trump, if he were removed from office. I just think that we have this is introducing a kind of fragility and a destabilizing quality to our political system that is really dangerous, and that I think that you know, could we really have to be worried about.
Peter Beinart from The Atlantic and Rob in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Rob.
Yeah, hi. I'm asking this question. In 2008, Hillary suggested the assassination of RFK in June, something relating to that issue. What is the difference between that and what Trump said in this election?
Sorry, what did Hillary say in 2008?
Hillary said he was, I think he was answering a question, and she said something that remember the assassination of in June of Bobby Kennedy also.
Oh, right. She, you know, there was a moment, and Peter, I don't have the exact reference, and I had forgotten about it until Rob, our caller, just brought it up. But there was something that was a little beyond the pale, wasn't there, with Hillary suggesting something about that Obama was at risk of being assassinated. Do you remember
it? Unfortunately, I also have a vague memory of it. I do think it provoked some outrage. But I think the difference was that I don't think Hillary Clinton was urging anybody to do that. I think she may have been kind of commenting on the possibility, and that alone provoked some anger from the Obama supporters. But I don't think she was suggesting in any way that this would be a good thing, or that this might be a, you know, the way to solve a problem.
Right. Let's see. Here's RNC Rule 9. You ready? Vacancies and nominations. The Republican National Committee is hereby authorized and empowered to fill any and all vacancies which may occur by reason of death, declination, or otherwise of the Republican candidate for President of the United States or the Republican candidate for Vice President as nominated by the National Convention or the Republican National Committee may reconvene the National Convention for the purpose of filling any such vacancies. In voting under this rule, the Republican National Committee members representing any state shall be entitled to cast the same number of votes, blah, blah, blah. Well, that doesn't suggest that they can remove the person. That suggests that if the person died or declined to continue his campaign, then they could replace him. Does it sound like that to you?
Yes, you're right. That was what, and that's what I've been hearing discussions about. I think that we've kind of passed the point of no return, unless Donald Trump decides he wants to get out of the race in terms of the Republicans nominating someone else.
There was a weird Clinton moment yesterday too, that at least bears mention. Sitting behind her at one of her rallies in the TV shot of her speaking was the father of the Orlando shooter. Did you see that?
I didn't see it, but I heard it discussed on TV this morning. And I gather that the Clinton campaign is saying that, you know, that he just got in, that wasn't, you know, that there was nothing planned about that. I can't really imagine why they would have wanted to have him in the screenshot, but it seems to me at the very least this is kind of pretty bad staff work to allow that to happen.
The earlier caller was listing Republicans who should be asked if they support Donald Trump. And one thing that we do know that has happened, which is one of the reasons that we originally invited you to come on today before this comment about Second Amendment people, you're a foreign policy expert. What do you make of the 50 Republican national security officials writing that statement in opposition to Trump? People like former national security advisors Tom Ridge and Michael Chertoff from the Bush administration.
Yeah, this follows a pattern we've seen, which Republican foreign policy folks have been especially critical of Donald Trump. You know, partly I think it's because they are not as
influenced by, you know, the domestic issues like Supreme Court nominations that might anchor some other Republicans in supporting Trump. They also generally work for people, George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, who themselves have not endorsed Trump. And Trump has, as many have discussed, has deviated pretty significantly from Republican foreign policy as practiced under George W. Bush, or as articulated by people like John McCain and Mitt Romney. So we're in an interesting moment. The Republican foreign policy class has become pretty unmoored from the Republican nominee. Were Donald Trump to be elected, I think there would be this would represent a kind of massive overhaul of what Republican foreign policy looks like.
Here's an example of, if not an official Republican, a conservative foreign policy expert speaking about Trump. This is Max Boot, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been an advisor to the John McCain campaign, and he served as an advisor to commanders in Iraq and Afghanistan, and has been generally a conservative-leaning commentator on the Iraq War and other things in the last 10 years, Max Boot on C-SPAN in May.
Well, the foreign policies and economic policies that Donald Trump advocates of isolationism and protectionism are the same policies that got us into the Great Depression and World War II. They would be an economic and foreign policy disaster for this country. He wants to abandon our nearest and dearest allies in places like South Korea, Japan, and Europe, while at the same time ingratiating himself with America's enemies like Vladimir Putin. He wants to ban Muslims from coming to the United States, which would be a gift to ISIS because it would hand them a propaganda victory by seemingly demonstrating to them what they claim to their followers, that the United States is an enemy of Islam.
Of Islam. And so Max Boot on May 10th on C-SPAN. And Peter Beinart, I guess if somebody wants to diminish the importance of this letter by the 50 Republican national security experts or people like Max Boot is that they're all sort of Bush-style neocons, or most of them are, and nobody's really for them anymore, and no, you know, not that many people give them credibility, and it was in progressive circles, say, seen as one of the good things about the Trump campaign that he was running against Bush-style interventionism.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's so strange about the Trump candidacy, is that there are things that Donald Trump has been saying, challenges that Donald Trump has kind of leveled against Republican orthodoxy on both domestic and foreign policy that are necessary and overdue, and that actually some smart conservative intellectuals themselves were saying were necessary. For instance, Donald Trump being a Republican who would call out the Bush administration for its failures to stop 9/11 or for the saying the Iraq War was a bad idea, or his willingness to say that American campaign finance is corrupt, or his willingness to say that America needs more infrastructure spending, or that maybe we don't need an overhaul of Social Security. A lot of smart conservatives have actually been thinking that Republicans needed that kind of intellectual shift. The problem, of course, is that it's wrapped up with Donald Trump. And so while I think there are a lot of serious critiques to be leveled at the Republican foreign policy establishment, I think an establishment that, to my mind, really hasn't learned enough from the disasters of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and hasn't thought enough about this endless push to extend America's military footprint and the kind of costs that it comes with. But you know, Donald Trump just lacks any real credibility to be the person making that critique. I mean, you know, if you're not even willing to put in the time to learn what the nuclear triad is, Donald Trump was asked that question twice about 6 months apart. It's one thing that he didn't know the answer the first time. The fact that he didn't know the answer the second time, to me, is really even more damning. And so I think it's a good thing that these people are coming forward. I have some significant ideological disagreements with him, but this letter didn't even talk about issues, actually. It really talked about knowledge and about temperament. And on those critiques, I think they're absolutely right.
You know, this comes as the situation in Syria seems to be reaching another military crisis point. And since you follow those issues closely, let me get a quick thought from you on that. In Aleppo, which seems to be surrounded again and possibly is going to be the scene of another Syrian government bombardment that could be extremely deadly, as well as produce new refugees. And there's been stuff written in recent days about Putin's role, Putin-backed Syrian forces, not so much against ISIS, but against the CIA-backed rebels. So this proxy war that maybe is heating up. You tell me if that's too strong a word, between Putin and the United States. What do you see happening?
Well, this is, to me, again, part of the tragedy of this presidential campaign, is that we are not debating these issues. We're debating Donald Trump's endless lunatic statements, you know, and we should be having a conversation about this. Syria will probably go down as the greatest foreign policy disaster of Barack Obama's presidency. It's not 100% entirely clear that it was within his control, but it is clear that the serious consequences for the world, for the politics of Europe, have been terrible. And we should be having a debate about what America could be doing. Should we be trying to overthrow Assad, which is in hopes of therefore strengthening a moderate opposition, as people like Marco Rubio support suggested? Should we be focusing on ISIS and basically making a kind of common cause with Assad and the Russians? Is there some leverage that we might have, some of cutting a deal with Russia and Syria that would allow us to have a transition to a post-Assad government? It's a very difficult debate, but I think it's the kind of debate, serious debate, that we really need to be having. Had the Republicans nominated someone else, I think, a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio, we would be having this debate, but we're not, because we're talking about the insane statements of Donald Trump.
What's your own answer as an expert in these issues to the questions you were just posing?
Gosh, you know, I really have to say that I need to, you know, be modest about this. I think that there may have been a moment when America could, by trying to strengthen a moderate opposition, have created an opportunity for a post-Assad government that would not either be a failed state or be dominated by the kind of the vicious theocrats of ISIS. That moment has probably passed. I do think at the end of the day, if this gets solved, it will be solved because of an accommodation that the U.S. is able to bring Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states along towards a kind of accommodation with Syria and Iran, and that we are going to have to recognize that Iran and Syria are serious players at the table, and that their concerns are going to have to be accommodated. Syria cannot turn into a kind of Sunni Islamist country that is a danger to Iran. But so I think one can imagine where the end goal of these negotiations might look like. The problem is that how to actually bring about that those kind of bargains, especially when the Saudis, we have less influence over the Saudis than we did before, I think is a very, very difficult thing to do right now.
By the way, to close the loop on something that an earlier caller brought up, what Hillary Clinton said during the 2008 campaign about a possible assassination of Barack Obama. Here's the quote. The context was why she was staying in the race in the primary season after it was clear that Obama would win the nomination. And she said, quote, "We all remember Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June in California," saying, you know, suggesting that, well, just in case something extreme like that were to happen, then I would still be here. Somebody would still be in the race. Now, obviously, if a leading candidate was assassinated, then one could get back in the race. And so she took a lot of criticism at the time for that. But I guess, as you were pointing out, it wasn't kind of a suggestion that maybe this would be a good thing, as we hear the Trump remark.
Yeah, you could. Maybe that was an unfortunate comment.
It was a bad comment.
But I think it's right. I think it's a different level of magnitude than suggesting that somehow this might be a good solution to a problem.
And actually, here is the chief national correspondent for Yahoo, says Lisa about who she is, calling on this point. Lisa, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's Lisa Belkin.
Belkin. Oh, my goodness. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
For those of you who don't know, former longtime New York Times correspondent, and I didn't know you were now the chief national correspondent for Yahoo. Hi.
And driving along and listening, and not to hijack the conversation back to the latest thing, but I just actually finished writing about that moment for another story, so I thought I would fill you in, but you seem very filled in. yes, Hillary was talking about timing. It was an unfortunate statement. It was not well phrased, but she was saying, well, yeah, things happen in June, so not time for me to drop out yet, as opposed to, you know, maybe somebody will do me a favor and shoot someone, which is a very different state.
Lisa, thanks. We'll have you back on something else as a guest. Debbie in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Debbie.
Good. I would like you to bring on an expert in dyslexia and language-based learning disabilities, because part of the continuum of dyslexia is not being able to figure out humor, sarcasm, and nuance. and dyslexia runs in the Trump family. And having a discussion about that and how our public schools do not address dyslexia and help people become advocates. You know, there's many successful dyslexics. David Boies could be president easily. Richard Branson is a successful dyslexic. And the numbers go on, except for in prison where half the prisoners are dyslexic. Huh. Could you bring on a language-based learning disability expert to talk about how this is affecting Donald Trump?
Well, it's obviously an important issue to talk about, dyslexia education and the implications of dyslexia for society in the ways you bring it up. But would it be too generous to Trump after a remark like this to seem to excuse it through dyslexia?
No, because it doesn't excuse his lack of self-awareness. A self-aware dyslexic takes time to figure out how to be a good public figure. Diana Swank doesn't directly tweet. She sends a text to an assistant who fixes her tweets and gets them out.
Debbie, thank you very much. And so let's end on this point, Peter. And kind of seriously, there's been a lot more psychoanalysis of Donald Trump in the media the last few weeks. You know, there have been some psychologists who've published. You probably read this stuff. Even David Brooks, who's not a psychologist, had his column last week trying to kind of, you know, diagnose Trump with narcissism or whatever. I was talking to a psychologist friend yesterday who says the psychology listservs are filled with professionals in the field who have their speculation about Donald Trump's, you know, clinical state. So I don't know. Is this a legitimate thing for conversation?
I mean, I guess the problem is, right, that, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, and my understanding is that you can't really diagnose people unless from afar, right? You actually have to actually treat them and talk to them. So it's probably not something that people can really effectively do. But I think we have reached a point, frankly, where, you know, this is so out of the normal bounds of what presidential candidates do that it does require us to start looking around for other kinds of explanations. And, the personalities of presidents as people, their characters, are very important. They can have tremendous implications for what happens to the country. So even though there's a kind of, you know, amateur pop psychological, you know, element to this, I suppose we need to do that, because whatever we're seeing with Donald Trump will be magnified dramatically if he's in the White House. The consequences of these statements will be much, much more important then. And so we have to try to get as good a picture as we possibly can of how this man operates and why he operates the way he does to understand what the danger might be.
Peter Beinart, contributing editor at The Atlantic and associate professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come. Stay with us.